Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook and Jack Dorsey of Twitter faced tough questions today from members of the Senate Judiciary Committee about their platforms, how they handle misinformation, and the social media's role in election 2020 and in the 2 weeks since. We'll have more on that story in a minute. This is Washington Today for Tuesday, November 17th. I'm John McArdle. First, some of the other headlines from around the nation's capital. In the House, leadership elections are taking place today and tomorrow for Democrats and Republicans, though neither party is expected to make any major changes to the top of its leadership team. At the Pentagon, Acting Defense Secretary Christopher Miller announced today that the United States will draw down its military presence in Afghanistan and Iraq by January 15th, just days before President-elect Joe Biden would take the oath of office. Miller said the move reflected President Trump's policy to, quote, bring the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq to a successful and responsible conclusion. But we begin today on the Senate side of the Capitol, where Zuckerberg and Dorsey appeared before the Senate Judiciary Committee, virtually, of course, for their latest round of questions from lawmakers. Republicans largely focused on accusations that big social media companies systemically censor conservatives and pointed to efforts by Facebook and Twitter to limit the spread of the New York Post's pre-election reporting on President-elect Joe Biden's son, Hunter. Senate Judiciary Chair Lindsey Graham, the Republican of South Carolina, also raised concerns about whether the tech giants designed their platforms to be, quote, addicting to users. Democrats, meanwhile, say the companies continue to let their platforms spread falsehoods, including President Donald Trump's continued claims to have won re-election. Here's Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg's opening remarks from this morning.
Last month's hearing, I spoke about the role internet platforms play in supporting democracy, keeping people safe, and upholding fundamental values like free expression. People have deeply held beliefs about these issues and can reach very different conclusions about the right balance. We try to do what's best for our community and the world, acknowledging that there are difficult trade-offs. I believe that some of these trade-offs and decisions would be better made through a democratic process, and I look forward to discussing that today.
That was Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg earlier today, also appearing before the Senate Judiciary Committee, Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey.
Thank you to the members of the Judiciary Committee for the opportunity to speak with the American people about Twitter and your concerns around censorship and suppression of a specific news article, and generally what we saw in the 2020 U.S. elections conversation. We were called here today because of an enforcement decision we made against the New York Post, based on a policy we created in 2018 to prevent Twitter from being used to spread hacked materials. This resulted in us blocking people from sharing a New York Post article publicly or privately. We made a quick interpretation using no other evidence that the materials in the article were obtained through hacking, and according to our policy, we blocked them from being spread. Upon further consideration, we admitted this action was wrong and corrected it within 24 hours.
Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey earlier today in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Senator Ted Cruz, the Republican of Texas, spent much of his time today questioning Dorsey about his company's recent practice of attaching disclaimers about voter fraud to tweets about that subject. Here's one exchange between Senator Cruz and Dorsey.
Is Twitter a publisher?
Is Twitter a publisher?
Yes.
No, we are not. We distribute information.
So what is a publisher?
An entity that is publishing under editorial guidelines and decisions.
Well, your answer happens to be contrary to the text of federal statute, particular section 230, which defines an information content provider as any person or entity that is responsible in whole or in part for the creation or development of information provided through the internet or any other interactive computer service. Let me ask you, was Twitter being a publisher when it censored the New York Post?
No, we have very clear policies on the conduct we enable on the platform. And if there's a violation, we take enforcement action, and people choose to commit to those policies and to those terms of service.
Except your policies are applied in a partisan and selective manner. You claim it was hacked materials, and yet you didn't block the distribution of the New York Times story that alleged to talk about President Trump's tax returns, even though a federal statute makes it a crime to distribute someone's tax returns without their consent. You didn't block any of that discussion, did you?
Our policy was focused on distribution of the actual hacked materials.
Did you block the discussion of the president's tax return material?
And in the New York Times case, we interpreted it as reporting about the hacked materials.
Did you block Edward Snowden when he illegally released material?
I don't have the answer to that.
The answer is no.
Republican Senator Ted Cruz and Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey earlier today. According to Fox News, today's hearing was, quote, largely about whether content decisions made by Twitter and Facebook turn them into publishers for the purposes of Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. That section protects platforms from being held liable for statements posted by users, end quote. Committee Chair Lindsey Graham of South Carolina and Senator Richard Blumenthal, Democrat of Connecticut, have introduced bipartisan legislation to reform Section 230. It's called the Earn It Act. We'll have more on that in a moment with Kat Sikorski of The Washington Post. But here's a portion of the hearing with Senator Blumenthal and Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg focusing on the comments made by former President Trump advisor Steve Bannon.
Let me ask about Facebook community standards, which ban language that, quote, incites or facilitates serious violence. As you know, on November 5th, Steve Bannon, in a Facebook Live video, called for beheadings of Dr. Fauci and FBI Director Wray for not acting more favorably toward President Trump. Twitter banned Bannon for these remarks. You removed the video, Mr. Zuckerberg, but on Thursday, you reportedly told Facebook employees that Bannon had not violated enough policies that he should be banned from Facebook. My question to you is, how many times has Steve Bannon allowed the call for the murder of government officials before Facebook suspends his account?
Senator, as you say, the content in question did violate our policies and we took it down. Having a content violation does not automatically mean your content, your account gets taken down, and the number of strikes varies depending on the amount, the type of offense. So if people are posting terrorist content or child exploitation content, then the first time that they do it, then we will take down their account. For other things, it's multiple. I'd be happy to follow up afterwards. We try not to disclose these
down his account.
Sorry, I didn't hear that.
Will you commit to taking down that account, Steve Bannon's account?
Senator, no, that's not what our policies would suggest that we should do in this case.
For more on today's Senate Judiciary Committee hearing, we're joined on the phone now by Washington Post technology reporter Kat Sikorski. Kat Sikorski, how much of today's hearing was focused on President Trump's social media postings and how Twitter and Facebook has treated them?
It was definitely a topic at the hearing that we heard a lot about, specifically from Democrats who really were critical that the companies haven't gone far enough in moderating tweets from President Trump in the weeks since the election. And, you know, there was really this kind of push and pull that we saw between what Republicans and what Democrats were saying on these issues, because Democrats were making the case that it's not clear these labels are effective and are, you know, really telling people that this is false information. But on the other hand, we heard from Republicans who were accusing the companies of going too far and said they were silencing conservative voices. But I'd say overall, we were expecting a heavy focus on that topic at the hearing, and it was something that came up frequently, but we also saw lawmakers jump from issue to issue, and it was a very unfocused and somewhat chaotic hearing.
That push and pull you talk about, Republicans saying that they went too far, Democrats saying they didn't do far enough, was either side able to get Jack Dorsey or Mark Zuckerberg to agree and make any policy changes in response to those concerns?
What I think we heard was the CEOs, as they have in previous hearings, stick really closely to just reiterating what their terms of services are, what their policies are, and why and how they apply them. So I don't think that we heard them talk about many changes that they themselves are going to make on their platforms that we hadn't heard about before today. But we did hear them weigh in a little bit about how they think lawmakers could change the regulations in this area to perhaps create some change in the industry. One interesting moment that I think we heard today was Mark Zuckerberg calling for industry-wide transparency reports that would allow for apples to apples comparisons of how well these tech companies are doing with content moderation. Right now, companies release these reports, but they vary widely from company to company. So for reporters like me, it's hard to compare how these companies are actually doing. So we did hear a greater openness, I think, from the tech executives to talk about changing existing internet laws like Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act and others, given the increasing political pressure.
Talk a little bit more about Section 230 and how Congress could change that. Is this sort of a stick that Congress could use to get Zuckerberg and Dorsey to address their concerns?
It certainly is. There's been an intense scrutiny on Section 230, which is this decades-old internet law that basically provides tech companies broad immunity from lawsuits for the content that people post on their services. And so this law is very important to the existence of these tech companies today. We heard Zuckerberg and Dorsey talk about how it would have been impossible for them to grow to the size that they are today without this law in the books. And lawmakers know how important it is to these tech companies, and they see that, you know, part of the reason on the Democrat side they think that companies have been hands-off is because they cannot face lawsuits for harmful content that people are posting on their platforms. But at the same time, on the Republican side, Section 230 also shields these companies from lawsuits over content moderation decisions. And so Republicans are making the case that, you know, if you're making these decisions that we repeatedly disagree with, maybe you shouldn't have these legal protections in place. Maybe you shouldn't have these special protections that newspapers and other communications publishers don't have. And so that's really an area that lawmakers from both parties have zeroed in on this law. They've signaled that it could be a bigger priority in the next Congress. But it's unclear where they go from here because there has been a lot of partisan infighting over what the reason is that these tech companies are being hauled in front of Congress today.
You talk about it possibly being a bigger priority in the next Congress. Is it a priority of a Biden administration?
We've seen indications that it is. As a candidate during the primary election, Joe Biden talked about the need to potentially revoke Section 230. And so that was a pretty bold statement from the Biden camp on that issue. We haven't heard much, though, from the Biden administration on if they were to revoke Section 230, what would a replacement look like, right? Because it would fundamentally be really problematic if you just got rid of this law altogether. And so I think, you know, most people are talking more about reforming Section 230 than repealing it outright. And so it remains to be seen how a Biden administration would handle such an issue. I think everyone's closely watching who was involved in the transition, who might be active on this. And, given the questions about the future of the Senate and the fact that we may have divided Congress again and with Republican control of the Senate, I think there's increasingly a feeling that, you know, this might have to be an issue where lawmakers are able to find a bipartisan consensus to really create major changes to this law.
And I guess finally, listeners have gotten used to hearing more from the heads of these giant tech companies, especially during these remote hearings during coronavirus in the last 6-7 months or so. Is that likely to continue in the 117th Congress? Are we going to be seeing Mark Zuckerberg and Jack Dorsey more often on Capitol Hill?
I think it will. I think most telling conclusions is at the end, Senator Richard Blumenthal said, you know, the only thing that's certain is that you'll be back, Mr. Dorsey and Mr. Zuckerberg. And so I think we can expect to continue to see these hearings. We heard lawmakers from both sides of the aisle talk about the importance not just to address the issues around content moderation, but also antitrust, data privacy, many other tech policy issues. And I think, you know, we've really seen a lot of scrutiny just on social media in recent weeks, given the election. But we also heard Blumenthal say, hey, like, we really should have the CEOs of Google and Amazon here testifying for us, too. So I think, you know, all of these tech CEOs are certainly going to be back on Capitol Hill. And during the pandemic, I would assume that will continue to be via WebEx and not in person. But really, it just kind of shows how the political tensions have shifted. You know, Mark Zuckerberg made it 14 years as CEO of Facebook without testifying in front of Congress once. And now, you know, he's been on the Hill just three times just since July. So it really has shifted.
Kat Zagreski is a technology reporter with The Washington Post. Covered today's hearing. You can see her work at WashingtonPost.com. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Well, a major announcement at the Pentagon today. Acting Defense Secretary Christopher Miller said today that the United States will reduce its military presence in Afghanistan to 2,500 troops and 2,500 troops in Iraq, both by January the 15th of 2021. The United States has approximately 4,500 troops currently in Afghanistan and more than 3,000 in Iraq. Here's the Acting Secretary of Defense, Christopher Miller, earlier today.
Good afternoon. I'm Chris Miller, Acting Secretary of Defense, and I'm here today to update you on President Trump's plan to bring the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq to a successful and responsible conclusion and to bring our brave service members home. From Kabul to Kandahar and from Mosul to Fallujah, hundreds of thousands of America's finest sons and daughters who selflessly answered the call to serve in the Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine Corps, and Coast Guard have brought us to this point. Their efforts and sacrifice will go down in history as epitomizing the strength, commitment, and empathy of a force that is unlike any the world has ever seen. Just last night, I joined Vice President Mike Pence and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Milley, to attend the dignified transfer of five American soldiers who perished on duty in the Middle East. This was a somber and humbling moment that reminded us of the tremendous sacrifices made by the men and women of the United States military in service of freedom and security. Our armed forces take an oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States. They serve not for personal gain, but for the protection and well-being of their fellow Americans and their homeland. They are champions for peace, liberty, and the rule of law, and unrelenting when called upon to defend our people and our values. We owe them and their loved ones an enormous debt of gratitude.
That was Acting Defense Secretary Christopher Miller. It was just last week that Christopher Miller ascended to the Pentagon's top role after President Donald Trump fired former Secretary of Defense Mark Esper. And it was earlier this year that the United States worked to broker a peace deal with the Taliban that would usher in a permanent ceasefire and reduce the U.S. military's footprint from approximately 13,000 to 8,600 in July 2020. The deal also called for all foreign forces to leave the war-torn country by May of 2021. You're listening to Washington Today. Welcome back to Washington Today. I'm John McArdle. Earlier today, Dr. Anthony Fauci, the nation's top infectious disease expert, said that as many as 20 million people could get a coronavirus vaccine by the end of the year or soon after. His remarks came during a Stat News 2020 summit. Here's Dr. Fauci earlier this morning reacting to Joe Biden's remarks yesterday, in which the president-elect said that more people could die if the Trump administration doesn't do more to ensure a working transition between administrations.
Have you been able to speak to President-elect Biden or any members of his COVID team?
I have not had contact with the president, with the vice president, Biden. No, I have not, Jim.
Okay. Biden said yesterday, and we just played this, that more people may die if the outgoing administration and the incoming administration don't coordinate. I wonder if you agree. Does this delay potentially cost lives?
Well, the only thing I can say, Jim, is that transitions are important. And if you don't have a smooth transition, you would not optimize whatever efforts you're doing right now. As you know, Jim, I've had the opportunity to serve six administrations, which amounted to five transitions. So I have been involved as a health person in the transition, and it is really quite important. As I used the metaphor the other day, it's kind of like a relay race in which you're passing the baton and you don't want to slow down what you're doing, but you want the person to whom you're giving the baton to be running with it as opposed to stopping and starting all over again. And that's the reason why it's important in every level to have a smooth transition.
What specifically, just so folks at home understand, what is lost? What would those communications be like now? What would the baton passing look like if there was communication like that?
Well, first of all, you can talk about things like what is the level of supply that's available? What is the utilization of PPEs? What about the hospital beds that the various members of the current coronavirus task force are in communication with the health groups in different states, getting interaction at a formal level with the governors, understanding every detail of the vaccine program, not only the two vaccines that have fortunately been shown to be very effective, but where are we in Operation Warp Speed with regard to the other candidates which are coming into their own in the sense of clinical trial accumulating data. All of those things can be done in partnership.
That sounds to me, as a layman, as things that matter, things that would make a difference.
Yeah, of course they would. As I mentioned, you know, I can recall in the transition that we had from the Obama administration to the Trump administration that then Chief of Staff Dennis McDonough worked with Reince Priebus and brought several of us together to talk about how we had handled Ebola, how we had handled Zika, to give them an idea of the kinds of things that you need to do. I mean, it's easy to hear about it in the news and to read about it, but when you sit down with somebody and talk about what went wrong, what went right, that's important.
That was Dr. Anthony Fauci earlier today on CNN. According to the New York Times, there were 166,581 new coronavirus cases reported in the United States yesterday. Meanwhile, in Washington today, House Republicans received a waiver to hold a large gathering at the Hyatt Hotel on Capitol Hill in order to hold their leadership elections in person. House Democrats, meanwhile, chose to hold their leadership elections in a virtual format this year. D.C. Homeland Security and Emergency Management Director Chris Rodriguez told CNN that his department worked with the Office of the Attending Physician on Capitol Hill and the D.C. Health Department to issue the waiver to the Republican conference. D.C.'s Phase 2 guidelines limit gatherings in hotels to 50 people. Here's newly reelected House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, Republican of California.
I want to congratulate Mike Johnson and Richard Hudson, who's new to our team, in representing with the rest of our colleagues. Over our past 2 years, our country has faced unbelievable challenges. And through every obstacle, I couldn't be prouder of the priorities of this conference. I can say without a doubt that this is the most united and energized Republican conference I've been associated with. We made a commitment to America that we would work to restore our way of life, rebuild the greatest economy, and renew the American dream. We've also worked to keep America safe. After Democrat leadership failed and bailed on our ability to work on the China task force, we went forward without them. And developing more than two-thirds of all the ideas in there to be bipartisan, to make a comprehensive blueprint to make sure we continue that America, that the next century is ours, that we bring back the work, the jobs, and the infrastructure into America. These efforts, contrasted with the dangerous Democrat agenda, delivered a historic political upset, fueled by conservative women, minorities, and veterans. As you all know, everybody predicted that the Republicans would lose 15 to 20 seats. Not one incumbent lost. On the Democrat side, more than a dozen lost. Much of that could be caused by Nancy Pelosi holding up any COVID relief bill simply for playing politics, or spending their time defunding police, or wasting their entire majority on an impeachment. Republicans are always focused on putting the people first before politics, and we will continue to do that work. In this next Congress, we might not be able to schedule the floor, but we are going to run the floor.
For more now on the House Republican agenda and one way the incoming freshman class could influence that agenda in the 117th Congress, we're joined on the phone now by Zoya Tierstein, a political reporter with Grist. Zoya Tierstein, the headline of your recent story this week, these House freshmen might actually care about climate change. What members-elect did you focus on?
Can you tell we're hedging there a little bit? You never really know. But it seems, yes, like friends are pointing towards some of these folks who are incoming, who ran on these environmental platforms, like Peter Meyer, for example. He's one I looked at. He's not an incumbent. He's a fresh face. And he ran in Michigan's 3rd District, and he won against a Democrat for an open seat. And he ran on this platform that included not only an environment plank, but also a PFAS plank, those with forever chemicals found in some water supplies around the country. He ran on what a Republican environmentalist looks like. And there's also, there's other examples as well. There's Maria Salazar in Florida. She won a seat, and she ran, of course, in Florida on a environment platform that included rising sea levels and climate change. So there are some folks, including a few incumbents, who might pursue climate policy in the 117th Congress. We'll have to see, though.
We'll have to see also how much support these folks are likely to get from the top of Republican leadership, specifically from Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy. What's been his stance on this issue?
Oh, that's such an interesting question, because Kevin McCarthy has been embracing climate action, actually, in the past couple of years, especially. I mean, that's sort of when he started ramping up his efforts to get what he thinks a Republican climate plan should look like from his side of the aisle. And the reason he's doing that is because he's getting a little nervous that the young members of his party don't have a climate plan to point to. And he's worried that he might lose those young voters. So he was behind this introduction a few months ago of this Republican climate plan. It included 4 planks in the House. And it's not exactly aggressive, but it is ambitious for the right, and includes carbon capture, storage, some regulations on power plants. So it's a start there.
Outside of Kevin McCarthy, who are some of the other veteran Republicans that might play a role here on the issue of climate change? Have Democrats been able to peel off some Republicans when it comes to climate votes during the 116th Congress?
Not exactly. There have been a few instances. For example, Brian Fitzpatrick, he's a representative from Pennsylvania. He has voted for a carbon tax proposal and has been behind an actual carbon tax proposal himself, a bipartisan one. And so he's someone I'm looking at. He's definitely played a role in what a Republican climate plan might look like, and he has been very vocal on the issue. There are a few others. Bruce Westerman of Arkansas is not a great example of someone who has a record that he can point to. He's got a 1% lifetime score from the League of Conservation Voters, but he did introduce the Trillion Trees Act as part of Kevin McCarthy's push to create a Republican climate plan. And so I'm going to watch him kind of carefully and see whether a few of these guys who say they're interested but haven't actually done anything to back it up quite yet make good on their promises.
Your article, again, it can be found at grist.org. It also focuses on some of the outside groups that are trying to influence these members of Congress. Explain what the American Conservation Coalition is.
Yeah, well, so, the left has no shortage of climate groups who are pushing their elected officials to go further on climate. On the right, it's a little more sparse, but there is this one group, like you mentioned, the American Conservation Coalition. It started as a youth climate group with a bunch of college conservatives who wanted to see their elected representatives do more on this issue. And then it kind of just spread. I mean, they're doing quite well. And that group endorsed 24 candidates for the House, and each one of the people they endorsed won their races. So I'm watching that group pretty carefully, because they seem to have their finger on the pulse of what voters want in terms of a Republican environmentalist.
And how are some of the more traditional, the more well-funded environmental groups, talking about the Sierra Club or the League of Conservation Voters, how do they feel about the American Conservation Coalition?
You know, I think those groups, and I haven't talked to them explicitly about this, but they have. I have talked to them for previous articles on the Eco Right, which is something you should check out if listeners don't know what that is. It's a new burgeoning group. But those groups are very welcoming of this perspective on climate. I mean, clearly the left has only been able to do so much in convincing these Republican representatives and senators to do something on climate change. So maybe folks from inside that party can do more and push those guys further on climate.
If you're interested in the topic, the headline of the story, "These Freshman House Republicans Might Actually Care About Climate Change." The article is at grist.org. The author is Zoya Tierstein. Appreciate your time.
Thanks so much.
On the Senate floor today, senators rejected a move to advance President Trump's nomination of Judy Shelton to the Federal Reserve Board. The vote failed in large part due to the absence of key Republican lawmakers and opposition from others. The move is the latest setback on the Fed for President Trump, who's seen several of his other picks for the central bank rebuffed. One of those to miss today's vote was Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley, which means that Grassley's 27-year streak of not missing a Senate vote came to an end today. The senator's absence was due to a possible exposure to coronavirus. His office announced that the senator is quarantining per medical advice as he awaits test results. Senator Grassley said in a statement that he's, quote, feeling well and not currently experiencing any symptoms. Here's Senator Grassley from the Senate floor on November 3rd, 2015, after casting what was then his 12,000th vote in the Senate.
Every year, Iowans in each county host me at a question and answer at their factories, their schools, their service clubs, or most of these are my own town meetings that I set up. I might get a dozen or so questions at each stop on any topic under the sun, and that's as it should be in representative government because that is a two-way street. The electorate job is to ask the questions, and my job is to answer them. If people are satisfied that I've answered their questions, or at least I tried to answer them, I hope that I've demonstrated how much their participation means to the process of representative government and to my casting my vote in Washington, because I bring the benefits of every comment, question, and criticism heard from Iowans to that vote. With these 12,000 votes, I think of the many conversations and pieces of correspondence behind each vote.
For more on Senator Chuck Grassley's historic voting streak that came to an end today, we're joined by one of the best resources on Senate history and procedure in the Congressional Press Corps, Roll Call Chief White House and Congressional Correspondent Niels Lisniewski. Niels, take us back 27 years, July 14th, 1993, the last time Senator Grassley missed a floor vote. What was the reason?
Well, it's sort of a remarkable streak. The last time that Senator Grassley missed votes, it was because he was with President Bill Clinton as they were touring flooding damage in Iowa. The summer of 1993 brought untold levels of flooding to all across the Great Plains, and the president, Clinton at the time, was doing a tour, and Grassley, being a senator from Iowa, accompanied the president on that trip, and he hasn't missed a single floor vote since then up until just this morning.
And how much pride does he take in that record? Is this something he likes to talk about?
Oh, Senator Grassley would talk about this streak all the time. It often would come up in the same context as he talking with pride about touring all 99 counties in Iowa every single year. It's sort of become one of the hallmarks of Senator Grassley, who is now 87 years old, and obviously the president pro tempore of the Senate is the longest serving member of the Republican Party. And it's sort of been one of his calling cards for so long, along with that 99 county tour. And it is, I suppose, the reality of 2020, that there's nothing more sort of predictable. If you had said that sometime during this year that the Grassley streak would end, that it would be in connection with COVID-19. And now hopefully this exposure obviously comes back negative, and it turns out that Senator Grassley and his wife, who Mrs. Grassley is also a familiar face on Capitol Hill, hopefully the two of them are both okay. But it is no surprise, really, I guess, that it would be coronavirus-related reasoning for the vote streak ending.
And listeners might know that proxy voting is available in the House and has been during the pandemic, but senators don't have that option, right?
That's right. There is no similar mechanism, at least on the Senate floor. Sometimes if you can get a quorum of members physically present, you can vote by proxy. At the committee level, and we might see Grassley do that at the Judiciary Committee later this week. But when it comes to the floor, Senator McConnell, the majority leader, has been insistent on members being physically present. There had been some discussion. Rob Portman, a Republican from Ohio, and Dick Durbin from Illinois, the minority whip, had been talking with some of their colleagues, I think, about some sort of updated procedures, but nothing like that ever took off. And so that's why, you know, we look at what happened today with the number of absences actually potentially affecting the vote outcome on the Shelton nomination, Judy Shelton's nomination to the Federal Reserve. This is the kind of thing that can actually happen during the pandemic, and it's actually a surprise how infrequently there have been sort of votes turned around or upended by pandemic-related absences.
And as you say, everyone wishing Senator Grassley well and that this possible exposure comes back negative. But now that this 27-year streak is at an end, do we know who's the next closest?
Yeah, the next closest, she has a couple of years still to catch up, but she was just reelected, so I guess she has the years now to catch up. It's Susan Collins from Maine, who, in fact, has never missed a roll call vote in her Senate career. Now, obviously, she arrived well after Chuck Grassley arrived in the Senate, but Senator Collins is, in fact, on a consecutive vote streak dating back to her arrival in the Senate.
As we said, for all things Senate and House history and procedure, Niels Lisniewski, the person to turn to. Roll Call's chief White House and congressional correspondent. Always appreciate your time.
Thank you.
And we thank you for joining us today on Washington Today. If you've missed any part of this program, remember you can listen to it wherever you listen to podcasts. Hope you enjoy the rest of your evening.